Welcome to a series of conversations based on the book How to Lead When You Don't Know Where You're Going by Susan Beaumont. My name is Major Bryce Davies and I'm part of the Salvos Faith Communities Development Team. If you would like to explore the topics covered in this series, please contact us at faithcommunities@salvationarmy.org.au as we're happy to discuss these topics with you and to facilitate opportunities for you to have further conversations with your people. Today my guest is Commissioner Miriam Glewis and Colonel Winsome Merritt, and we're going to be having a look at Chapter 5 of the book, Shaping Institutional Memory. Well, welcome, ladies. Good to have you with us. And we're looking today at Chapter 5. And let me read to you the little spiel that Susan Beaumont puts in the beginning of her book about Chapter 5, which is Shaping Institutional Memory. Tell me our story. In liminal seasons, we have clarity only about the past. This condition can invite an unhealthy relationship with the past. The temptation is to glamorize our glory eras. We create thin narratives about how wonderful things were back then, or we truncate our memories to block out experiences of pain and shame. Memory shaping helps the organization rightly remember stories from the past so that those stories teach important values for the present and shape a hope-filled future. So the way we tell our stories and the way we think about our movement is a really important part of how we get through a liminal season. So it'll be great to chat this through with you both. So welcome, Miriam and Winsome. Good to have you here. One of the things I wanted to do, Miriam, is to just ask you what are some of the stories that really impacted you in terms of the Salvation Army and its history and your favourite stories, I guess.
I think there's probably several. I love when the guys went to jail because they were standing up against the slavery. I love the Matchbox story where we delivered people from the Fosse Jaw and gave them a start. I also love that we were really nimble. We'd sort one issue, move to the next one. I think all of our stories are about seeing where there was a need, how we could meet it in sometimes the most extraordinary ways and very entrepreneurial for the times. So I think all of our stories speak to that and it's very, very exciting.
Yeah. What about you, Winsome? What do you like?
I like the story that William Booth tells about the bird with two wings, the evangelical wing and the social wing. And if you, you know, pull them apart, it ceases to be a bird. You need both wings to fly. I love that story. I think it's very helpful in our current context. But also the story of William saying to his son Bramwell about the people who are experiencing homelessness, sleeping under the bridge, you know, go do something. This sense of responding immediately to a need that, you know, relates to Miriam's comment around us being nimble and agile.
I know for me, I see pictures of our past and things like our bushfire responses or even the Westgate Bridge. I grew up in Melbourne and I was a very small child when the Westgate Bridge collapsed. And I can still remember images of the Salvos, you know, doing their emergency work in spaces like that. That's classic Salvation Army, isn't it? There when the need is great and nobody really knows what to do, but we're going to be there present in the mix, doing what we can to make things better.
In the past, it was the wars that we were known for and people always remembered that we'd turn up. Now it's when we have a disaster and the Salvos are there and they're on the front line and they're serving and showing kindness. That's what we're known for. So how do we stay in the spaces, whether it's the bus crash just recently at Cessnock and we have people making sure they care about people, showing kindness? I think, what are we known for at the time? And it must always be that we're serving, loving, showing Jesus and being kind. And people remember that for a lifetime.
Yeah. Are there times for you, Winsome, when a story happened in your lifetime, when you look back at your childhood, are there stories that you reflect on and go, that's why I'm a Salvo?
I would have to go to Alice Springs, where my parents started the work there. And just the DNA of the Army in terms of our response to even homelessness. So, you know, a hostel was built for men experiencing homelessness. It was only 12 beds at that time, but that happened within the first six years of the Salvation Army being formally in Alice Springs. For me too, you know, in those days, open airs were still a thing because people hung around the streets and we would have open airs, just the six of us in the family. And each of us were allocated a duty. None of us were very long. My brother, who was eight, held the flag. I was six. I gave out little tickets to kids. My mother played an accordion, and they had a, you know, a record player hooked up to the car battery, and it would play Burl Ives. That tells you how old it is, in the poorer sections of town. But the Sunday school grew from that. And then in the town itself on a Saturday night, there'd be open airs with many First Nations peoples gathered, as well as others. And I actually recall an Aboriginal man kneeling at the drum in an open air meeting. I was a child, I was 8 or 10. Those kinds of memories are significant and last, and you see life transformation as a result of those. So for me, yes, those early childhood memories of a church plant, before them being called that, where people's lives were radically transformed by an encounter with Jesus, has definitely impacted my understanding of what church is and what it means to be a sent person into the community, so that people hear and experience the love of God for themselves.
Yeah. What about you, Miriam?
Oh, probably three quick ones. My grandmother had a profound effect on me. So just her godliness, the fact that, you know, I would see her kneel down and pray, and then I'd see her at the army and giving 100% to everything that she did and was. I think too, when I was a young girl, six key people from our core went to training college. I thought, wow, and they are amazing. So I want to be like them. So they were always great role models. And I think another story, and it's a bit later on, but again, it's around a drum. I'd heard these stories, you know, how people got saved at the drum. I thought, that's a bit odd. And then I went to Papua New Guinea, and I'm standing in the middle of Koki and hundreds of people, and people getting saved at the drum. I thought, God, you still do it. I have to tell you a bit of a funny story, though, because after that, two of the officers came up to me and said, Colonel, your friend, she's a very good dancer. You need more practice. So there you go. They got saved at the drum without my good dancing.
I think a lasting memory for me is I used to play basketball with Dave Eldridge and a crew from the St Kilda Crisis Centre. These were tough, tattooed, big, scary-looking guys, and I was a teenager, and I'd play against these guys, and Dave and his crew just loved these guys. We had so much fun, and it just shifted these guys from being all scary and criminals and bad people to being just normal blokes who want to have a game of basketball. And yeah, they're a bit rough, but actually they're good-hearted. And I think it made a big impact on me to see that side of life. One of the things Susan talks about in her book is kind of glamorizing stories. She tells a story about this person who's looking to find the best archer. And he goes to this forest and he sees a tree with a bullseye in it and an arrow right in the middle of that bullseye. And this person goes along and finds hundreds of trees with bullseyes with arrows dead straight in the middle of them. And then he finds a barn. And it turns out that there's this bloke who shoots arrows into barns and trees and then paints bullseyes around them. It looks like he's an amazing archer. So it's kind of like, how have we sometimes told our stories and glamorized them or made them to look a lot better than they are? And what are some of the dangers of that for our present stage in liminality, do you think?
Look, I think we glamorized probably the 50s and 60s when we thought everything was going well but wasn't going so well, because I think that's when we went inside our buildings and instead of being this sent force and booed the army for the, you know, the underdog and for the people who didn't have church, all of a sudden we were sitting in churches looking very nice in our uniforms with our bands and our songsters, and nothing wrong with any of those things except we internalized. And we sang our own songs and played our own music, and we probably weren't the sent people that we thought we'd always been. And I think that caused us some grief, and it sounds very nice, but actually there began the decline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think, Winsome?
Mine's a little different example. I think the Salvation Army in the past has been quite proud of its stated value of equality between men and women, you know, in ministry and leadership. I think the reality is quite different and has probably always been quite different. We are very privileged because we do not have to fight for women to be involved in ministry at all. We think it was about equality in leadership, but actually the reality is it wasn't. We probably got more equality today than we had in the past, in our very early beginnings. And today, I think we've still got a way to go in terms of women being able to be in leadership roles in the Salvation Army, both territorially and around the world. I mean, Miriam and I, it's an exception to the rule. And given our demographic, probably should reflect this situation more frequently. So I think that's part of our history that we've glamorised, thinking, you know, and we are very privileged because we don't have to fight those battles that many other women in other churches do. Don't get me wrong. But I think in that sense of privilege and being given that privilege, we have perhaps glamorised that beyond the reality of what it is. So I think that's tripped us up a little bit sometimes in terms of ensuring opportunities for women to be developed and being able to have opportunities to get into leadership positions or have that leadership development that's necessary.
And I think that's true, Bryce. I back Winston in that. As a single, I've had numerous opportunities. I've been very, very blessed, but it's always been in a man's world, and to see married women now rising up like Winsome, and I think it's been much more difficult for them. I think now we're getting to where we need to go. Even though we talk about Catherine Booth and how marvellous she was, I think it's taken a long time.
Yeah.
We may have had the words right, but we might not have had the culture right for that to have been really fostered and nurtured and permission given for that.
So it was well and truly written into our ONRs. I remember reading, you know, every woman shall have the opportunity to lead or to be involved in any kind of environment in terms of ministry and leadership, but it never translated into reality. So we are moving, still got a way to go.
I guess too, part of being nimble and having young people given a go and all of that positive stuff we have in our storytelling doesn't tell the story of the disasters. And, you know, things like the Royal Commission have started to highlight some of the dangers of just letting people do whatever they want and being a little bit sort of too nimble. You know, you can be too nimble and too flexible. You have to have some structure and governance to make all of that right.
Yeah, it's a different world, isn't it? And we still want to be innovative and creative, but we also have to be safe. And that's come back to bite us way too many times. We don't want that to ever happen again. So I think the warning is, let's be absolutely safe, but let's never shy away from being innovative and creative, because that's the kind of God we have. And the people who had given it a go, oh my goodness, we got some magnificent stories.
Yeah. And they're not mutually incompatible, are they? Safety and innovation. Yeah.
One of the things Susan talks about is that there's a power play in the telling of stories, and that our top leaders, she would suggest, will tell the stories in a certain way so that it shines good light on them or backs up their point of view. Is it tempting, do you think, in leadership to grab a story to make a point and actually the truth's kind of on the fringes a bit?
Bryce, how could you say such a thing?
Sue would say, you're a great storyteller, Bryce, and never let the truth get in the way.
I love stories. I'm a storyteller, and I love to hear. Look, I've heard the most amazing stories on the weekend of people coming from great adversity to people cheering them on and watch what God does. So, look, I think these are the days when we have to be absolutely focused. So even in the Salvation Army right now, we've got to be absolutely focused. So I will use any story that keeps us on track with that. So I think that's a gift and an art, and we need a lot more storytellers, but we also need a lot more creatives. When Winston was talking earlier about the bird with two wings, I love that, because the bird doesn't fly if you don't get the two wings right. So where are the people who are our artists who can depict that both in conservative, contemporary, modern art, whatever that looks like, to say, here is our story, here is our theology, our DNA. What is our key messaging around that? Look, I think our team are marvellous at that. Our internal comms, just brilliant at telling our story, keeping us on track. We're going to see Australia transformed one life at a time, with the love of Jesus. So what are the stories? Because that's the story we're going to champion, and we're going to do it again and again and again. Because I described myself the other day as the road runner, running down the road fast, beep, beep, sometimes annoying, but always on message. So I think our stories have to tell the message of the day, and boy, there's some good ones.
I have to agree with you, Miriam. There is power in telling stories to illustrate a truth and to illustrate how our vision is being fulfilled, transforming Australia one life at a time with the love of Jesus. And there are lots of stories out there about people's lives being transformed with those beautiful expressions of the love of Jesus, both through our social programs and through our core. And when they do it together, it is the most effective and the most powerful, I think. So I think storytelling increasingly is going to be a necessary skill. And I love the idea of being able to tell that story in an art form. There've got to be salvationists and, you know, adherents and friends out there who have that ability to be able to tell the army's story simply in an artistic form. You know, picture paints 1,000 words. I'd certainly be, let's encourage that medium as well.
And it used to be the war cry, didn't it? We used to have this paper way that came out once a week or once a month or something that told the story. So we've got a rich tradition of being storytellers and getting testimonies out there. So, and now in this age of Facebook and social media, we just have so many opportunities to tell the stories of those transformations that are happening all over the place. And it's a very exciting age that's our position. One of the other things that the Salvation Army has suffered from a little bit is the way we've done leadership and the way we've moved officers from one appointment to the next. And a lot of officers' kids don't speak highly of that. And there's this story, if you like, that I'm not sure if we've glamorized it, but it's part of our story is that we've had this, I guess, transience about our leadership that's had some consequences. And I'm not sure how we tell that story these days, because obviously officership is an issue for us as a movement, and we want to make sure that families are valued and that officers stay stable. How do we tell that story or retell that story, or even how do we tell the story of the past in a way that helps us shape our future?
I'm an officer's kid, and yes, I recall a move in particular. You know, when we moved from Alice Springs to Darwin, I was that critical age, 12, 13. I took a long time to adjust to that move. And I know my parents and my grandparents were very concerned about me and my mental health. I don't think that was a term in those days. So it's a really interesting concept, because the parents are called to ministry and to serve, and to a certain extent they have to trust that God has this for their family. And today's culture, you know, it's very different to what it was 20 or 30 years ago. So, yes, we have to take families into consideration way more than we ever did. And I think we are really beginning to struggle in a positive way with what this means for officership today. I know Miriam and I and, you know, Secretary for Personnel, we're having conversations around what does this look like for us today? Because to be an officer, I think the old term, in fact, I think it was in the envelope I got when I was commissioned, a little, you know, leaflet, where I think it's I don't know if it's peregrinator, but it means you're someone who travels around, basically, with the gospel message. You are transient. You know, one of the strengths of officership was our availability. So the things that used to be in our favour are actually concerns in today's culture, particularly for families. So how do we work through those issues, and what does officership actually mean these days? If it's not about availability, what do we work, you know, how do we work through these concerns and these issues? Because we don't want children to be traumatised because they're children of officer parents. We want them to catch a glimpse of the possibilities of ministry and what it means to work in and for the kingdom of God. And that's my overriding sense as an adult of my childhood, not the difficulty in transition from one appointment of my parents to the next. You know, for me, it was about the absolute vitality of the church and the way in which it provided space and opportunity for people's lives to be transformed with God's love. That's what we want the children of our parents to actually experience and see and be motivated to stay as people of the kingdom. We don't want to be losing our children, certainly not our officers' children.
This is a really tough one because to me, it's God and then family and then Salvation Army. And I think we've often got this pretty wrong. So how do we get it absolutely right? So for me, family is really, really important. So how do we look after kids? How do we love them well? And I think, you know, there are some kids who've walked right away from the church and others who are some of our best leaders within the church. So I'm not quite sure sometimes, and I would not like to say, because you wouldn't want judgment to be on anyone with that, because I think kids are absolutely loved. I think these are different days and people do want to be around family, whatever that looks like. Some are happy to go anywhere, but I think we just have to take into the needs of the particular family, their children, how they're feeling. But I think we need to also ask God. So, you know, I went to PNG at the 3-year mark. My mum had dementia and I felt I was supposed to come home. So I did. That was very disconcerting for some, but I trusted him and believed that he would be in that. I did not make a mistake. They were some of the 3 best years I got to spend with my mum before she passed away.
It seems to me that in the last 20 years or so, that's really shifted enormously, and there's a greater focus on making sure people are in the right place with their kids and their family and their personal circumstances. So
yeah,
that's a real tick to the Salvation Army, I think.
We probably still need to get a bit better at it, but it is a challenge.
Yeah.
It is a significant challenge for us, I think.
One of the other parts of our history is the way we've treated Indigenous people, not just the Salvation Army, but Australians overall. And we've got to wear that a bit, and our history with Indigenous people has been probably good and bad.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Cherbourg, I think, I mean, I didn't know that history until Australia became one territory. Mm. But I think that's in the process of reconciliation now. Mm. We've not done Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ministry effectively, I don't think, in our past generally. I think the fact that we now have an ATSI team, I think it's really positive, and that they're leading this ministry, we're listening better. I think all of those things are positive. We've got a way to go, but I think the possibilities are, they're endless. I'm actually really excited about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander ministry in this country.
And they're all very beautiful and wise people, aren't they? And just how they deal with grace and respect. And I would hope every salvo would do the same.
They are a beautiful team.
Yep.
One of the things that we seem to have a bit of a reputation for is being innovative and on the front foot in terms of how to impact community and how to do ministry. And we've got a bit of a reputation for that in our stories and in our past. It's a challenge to keep that active and dynamic, isn't it, Miriam?
It is, but I still think we've got some amazing examples. And if I go into inner city Melbourne, I hear about the new Prison Gate ministry starting again, and how, you know, this terrible football club called Collingwood are part of it, and they work with Brendan Nottle. They work with, we'll just stamp that out. They work with everyone that they can in the inner city, with our prison chaplains, with whoever, with the recovery church, with people who just get beside people. And then I hear that once they're in the magpie nest and come to the recovery church, the first lady who's come out of prison, who goes in, is now taking a faith journey because she came to recovery church. Then I go to Queensland, I see a young guy who's given a cafe and has all the favour in the world as far as homelessness goes. And people just want to give, they want to volunteer, they want to help, they want to donate coffee, they want to give all sorts of things because a creative idea is spurred. So we've got the people, we've given the permission, so let's go.
Yeah. I think the innovation on our front line is occurring all the time.
Yes.
And perhaps it's not recognised as innovation, but many of our frontline are doing innovative things all the time, every week.
Yes.
Miriam's examples, and I know new approaches to connecting with people and to helping them. I think of the well at St Kilda, and then I think of the work that happens in Frankston in the schools through a group of chaplains, primary schools, just with, you know, primary school kids teaching them basic life skills. And
the garden in WA?
Yeah, the Garden of Hope. I mean, our frontline people are really quite amazing.
They are, aren't they?
And innovative, and we would want to honour that.
So what are the fresh stories? I think, Miriam, I'm prompting you to tell a fresh story of innovation and hope and all the good stuff that the Salvation Army is, because you witnessed something beautiful over the weekend, didn't you, when one of our runners came across the line?
Oh my goodness. So for 10 years now, the Salvos in Australia have had a partnership with Papua New Guinea. It's called Hope in a Future Project. And if you know PNG, so few people get jobs. So what we do is we get 8 kids, 2 mentors to run a marathon, 42 point something Ks, mind you. We give them an education, so we pay for their education. We give them some spiritual input and some leadership input. So 4 things. In 10 years, with a couple of years out for COVID, every single young person has made that marathon. Everyone has been given the opportunity of an education. Most have now got a job back in Papua New Guinea, which is miraculous, and they're giving back. They're all leaders within their core, etc. But there was a beautiful moment. I'm sitting at the finish line and the guy's saying, 5 minutes to go and we're going to get everyone home. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, where's Rata? Where's Sharon? And I'm thinking, she cannot be the only kid who goes back without a medal. Then all of a sudden I look up the chute and I think, oh my goodness, there she is. But the whole team, it makes me cry every time, the whole team are rallying behind her and cheering her on, and she runs to that finish line, and it's the most beautiful moment because it's not just us cheering, but it is the whole team cheering. And when I think of a story, that's the story of the church. We're cheering everyone on to get to that finish line so that they might flourish in life. And I will never forget that moment, because that's who we are. And that's our vision statement, is it? One life at a time, yeah, with the love of Jesus. I will always remember that picture. That's a story from 1 day or 2 days ago. So God keeps doing it. So we've got to keep believing it's going to keep happening.
That's a great picture. One life. But all those people behind, cheering her on, making sure she crossed the finish line.
And all the volunteers and everyone from the marathon, they're all there and high-fiving her as she comes across the line.
Amazing.
Beautiful. Mm. Which talks to another thing, doesn't it? It's not just about Salvos, it's everyone who supports us, which is magnificent.
Yeah. What's a story that's really captured your heart recently, Winsome?
There was a story I heard. I got it through my emails, and it's just recent. It's the story of a lady who had come to faith but had a very challenging, you know, period in her life. And a lady who'd been working with her and discipling with her was in the shops with her. So they were in the shops together. But the lady who had, you know, had come to faith and was being discipled was estranged from her son. Hadn't spoken to him, I think, in a number of years. And it was obviously a burden for her. And in the shop, they both saw her son. And the lady didn't quite know what to do, didn't want to make the first approach, I don't think, but her and her friend spent 10 minutes praying together that God would intervene. Anyway, on his way out of the shop, he saw his mum and he came over and he gave her a hug.
Oh, wow.
And then I think they made arrangements to catch up, but that for me is a really simple story about the power of prayer. You know, the lady who was discipling her had enough wisdom and not bothered by the external environment to say, you know, we're going to pray that God would intervene and make it possible for reconciliation.
Wonderful.
You know, reconciliation is at God's heart. I just think that is a beautiful little cameo of a number of things.
There's so many stories, isn't there? And it's probably a healthy thing to encourage our people to actually hook into the Salvos online. And there's just so much good stuff that we can rely on as truth, and they really help us to dream big about what we can do into the future, hey? So thanks heaps, guys. Thanks for listening to this leadership series. If you would like to explore these themes and conversations more, please feel free to contact us at faithcommunities@salvationarmy.org.au. Bless you.